What is up, basketball fans? Welcome to a live playoff edition of the NBA Island. I'm your host, Nick Fay. With me, as always, Corey, two Andre Waldron, and guest Dalton Pence.
Dalton's got a weird face. I had two entrees on Saturday night when we all went out to dinner.
I'm not blaming you. I probably would have done the same, honestly.
Playoffs, huh? Playoffs. I'm throwing in the white shirt for white flag for the Pacers. I'm throwing in the towel.
Dalton and I are repping, got the Nets shirt on for game two. Dalton's got the Clutch City jersey on. Obviously, pretty pumped. Great weekend of basketball. Ton of fun. Got to spend some time with Corey and Jack watching the games on Saturday. Dalton, I know you're pretty hyped after last night. And as always, quick reminder, check us out, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, Google Play, and YouTube. But guys, let's get into it. Right from the start, we'll start with Saturday's games. Obviously, you know, we had some upsets on Saturday to start us off. We had Brooklyn Nets, Philadelphia 76ers, game one. Nets picked up the W, 111-102. Quick thoughts on that one.
I think you have to be ecstatic if you're Brooklyn, being able to steal one on the road, being a lower seed. I think it's very encouraging. You have Russell, LeVert, and Dinwiddie both combining for 67 and beating Philadelphia when Jimmy Butler goes off for 36 points on 50% shooting. I really think you can't be too much more excited than Brooklyn could have been on Saturday night. Or Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, being the lower seed, being on the road in Philly, going against, you know, the Fantastic Five, as it's been mentioned, with a P, you know, like fat, P-H-T. but, I mean, you know, Joel Embiid was, you know, limp, not 50, 80%, whatever you want to give his health status, wasn't 100%. Jimmy Butler had 32. Nets limited him to just 4 points in the fourth quarter. The Nets had all three of their guards lighted up between D'Lo, who even had a slow first half, but a really good second half. Spencer Dinwiddie was crucial off the bench in isolation. Caris LeVert himself almost outscored the 76ers bench. Again, I think it was 59-26, the bench score differential, which was crucial. Jared Dudley was a spark plug off the bench. Unfortunately, he's not going to be available in game two. But I mean, from Brooklyn's standpoint, you got to feel good. The team's got to have a lot of confidence. They play decently well against some tough teams to end the year. They get the first win on the road. The 76ers have some issues between the Amir Johnson cell phone thing, however much stake you want to put into that, the fact that Joel Embiid had to cart to the press conference, and the fact that fans were leaving with 3 minutes to go, the fact that fans were booing Ben Simmons at the free throw line. Like, there's just a lot of drama around the 76ers, which for me personally, I think it just slides everything more in favor of Brooklyn for the fact that all of this kind of chaos is going on with Philly.
Yeah, and lost in all this is a really big win for the Nets organization and Nets culture. Kenny Atkinson, Sean Marks getting their first win. This is a young group. You know, D'Angelo Russell, first playoff game. Caris LeVert, first playoff game. Jared Allen, Rodions. You know, Spencer Dinwiddie played a couple minutes with his Detroit. Obviously, they have the vets, like Corey mentioned, Jared Dudley, Ed Davis, Damari Carroll, kind of stabilizing everything. But I think if you're the Nets looking at this series, and obviously slightly biased, you want an in-depth breakdown, check out the Brooklyn Buzz. But there's some matchups they can really expose. You know, we talked about this, having guard play like D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie, and Caris LeVert, there's a good chance two out of three of those guys are going to have a good game. And Philly only really has one great on-ball defender in Jimmy Butler. Ben Simmons was okay. He's had good moments during the season. But trying to defend a smaller guy the entire game is giving them issues. Their pick-and-roll defense was really bad. You know, Boban's not going to get out and defend that mid-range shot. Like Corey mentioned, Embiid's only 80%. So there's some real positives for the Nets. Game two is going to be big. You know, Corey mentioned Jared Dudley's going to be out. Ed Davis is still questionable. Joel Embiid's still questionable. We don't know what's going to happen with those two. We'll probably know by the end of the show. But I think if you're the Nets going to this game, it built a lot of confidence. Being a young team, getting that win. Where would you guys put the upset ability in this game? You know, like going into it, you know, some people probably weren't that high. But after game one, a game where the Nets pretty much beat the Sixers from the end of the first quarter to the rest of the game, what are your thoughts on the chances of an upset in this one? Obviously, only one game played, but still.
An upset in the series or an upset in like
in the series. We'll talk specifically game two is a little bit later. We're kind of break down.
I think going into the series, I actually had Brooklyn winning this series just because of all the political upheaval that's going on within Philadelphia.
He's trying to suck up right now. No, I'm just kidding.
In that organization. But I received a lot of heat in the group chat for saying that I thought Brooklyn was going to win. But I think before game one went, I kind of had them at a four. But I think it's more along the lines of like a five or six now, just because I don't want to put too much stock into a one-game win. But I just think that there's so much kind of, I guess you would say, a little bit of upheaval in terms of what's going on in Philly. And that's kind of shows to what's made to be true and all the kind of the undertalk of how is this core in Philadelphia going to mesh, especially after they got Butler, after they got Harris. You know, it looks good on paper. You've got four guys who could be a potentially face of a franchise one day. But how are they going to mesh well together? And it kind of epitomizes my preference of cohesion and effort over necessary talent. And I think it kind of resembles a run of maybe the 2011 Mavericks in a sense, just because of how they beat a team like Miami. And I'm not saying that this is an NBA Finals Nets team, Nick, sorry. But, you know, I think that there's a definite chance for upset here, and I'm actually calling it, so.
Yeah, I mean, originally I had the Sixers in five. But that was also because, as me and Nick mentioned a little bit yesterday talking, or not yesterday, Saturday talking pregame, I really didn't, I wasn't fully aware of the injury to Joel Embiid's knee. Like, I wasn't positive of the severity of it. I probably would have said still Sixers and six. I still think the talent's there. But I will say, you know, I know we're going to talk about the game two later. I think if the Nets personally win tonight, the Nets will win this series. I do not believe going back home to Brooklyn that the Brooklyn Nets can't win one game, forcing it to be 3-1 and then not being able to close out. Now, granted, you know, we've seen a 3-1 lead be blown and stuff like that, but I feel really good for Brooklyn winning this series if they are able to win tonight. Because then I also think the locker room issue then for Philadelphia gets expedited hugely. Fans, you know, already booing after game one, they lose another game, that fan base will be almost intolerable with their own team, which is ridiculous to even think about. Who knows Embiid status? So right now, I'd probably say I'd give the Nets a 40% chance to win this series as of right now after game one.
Yeah, and I think you look at Embiid, and we talked about this on Saturday as well. Not really sure if he's going to get to 100% in the series. It seems very unlikely, especially with the way he looked after the game, being on the cart to the press conference. The Nets did just get some positive news. Ed Davis will play tonight, so that was big. Good. He was arguably their starting center in that game. Jared Allen played a couple minutes, obviously being the young guy, not having the size to deal with those big centers. But it's a really good chance for the Nets to upset. I'll give my thoughts on the Brooklyn Buzz, so you can check that out. Moving on to another game one that was pretty much a big surprise. I thought some people thought the Nets could win game one, but not many people thought Orlando would win game one in Toronto, 104-101, with DJ Augustine balling out.
DJ Augustine, man, what a trooper. You know, this is a guy that it seems like for the past however many years or so, even when they took Elfrid Payton back in the draft, I forget what year that was, it's been so long, but I mean, DJ Augustine's been a guy who's always been kind of put on the back burner, and seeing him actually come into this game and show out up north is absolutely phenomenal. But the thing that really got me was, you know, we've been hearing about Toronto's playoff struggles pretty much perennially since Lowry and DeRozan have been in the playoffs for Toronto. No DeRozan this year, but Lowry still 0-for-7 from the field, which is absolutely staggering and both alarming and absolutely scary for Toronto. Now, I do think Toronto will win this series, but definitely not an encouraging game from the Toronto point guard. So,
yeah, I mean, DJ Augustine, we mentioned it a few times on the outlet throughout the year. He had a career year. You know, obviously, ideally, you don't want him as your starting point guard. You probably would like him to be a six man, but he's done tremendous with his opportunity in Orlando. And, you know, he beat Kyle Lowry head to head. He was the better point guard in game one. Now, granted, you know, Kyle Lowry makes one or two of those shots, the game is in Toronto's favor. Kyle Lowry, as Jack Manuel mentioned on our live recap, was still plus 11 for the game, had 7 rebounds, 8 assists. It wasn't like he wasn't impacting the game. I know he had a quote saying, just because I didn't score doesn't mean I didn't have a positive impact on the game for my team, which, you know, to a degree is true, because realistically, he still had a positive plus minus. He still had certain stats. He still was a decent defender. The issue is, personally, you know, you didn't score any, and the guy you're guarding most of the time at 25 points, so you were getting toasted a little bit on the defensive end. But for Toronto, you know, I said Toronto in six, and now that looks really good. So I think Orlando can definitely win at least one game at home. And, you know, Aaron Gordon looked impressive from what we watched. We were kind of like too hyped for the Nets game in the first half, and then we got locked in the second half. Aaron Gordon was spectacular in the second half, and I was really surprised by the Raptors' lack of getting Kawhi Leonard involved. Yes, Kawhi still had 25 points. He still shot over 50% from the field, but it felt like he didn't get going till late. It felt like he was being underused. They went to Pascal Siakam a lot, which wasn't bad because he was really efficient and effective too. But I think Kawhi's got to be more involved. But once again, what you said, Dalton, you know, this once again raises the question of, can Toronto just not get it done in the playoffs? And that's how I feel again after game one.
Yeah, and I think specifically Lowry, you know, he did have a positive impact without scoring, but I think any situation where you're a team's top three player, you know, whatever you want to call him, he's the second or third best, doesn't really matter. You expect him to score, and he didn't score in that situation. That did hurt them. And we didn't talk about this really in the Nets and the Sixers matchup. Coaching was huge in that matchup. Kenny Atkinson had the nod over Brett Brown, and this matchup, Steve Clifford had the nod over Nick Nurse. There were situations where you need to get Kawhi involved, and Corey, you mentioned Aaron Gordon being very engaged. Yo, get Kawhi some free looks, get him some open looks, get him some switches. It just felt like Orlando had a better feel for what they wanted to do in this game than Toronto did. It was like Toronto was almost feeling them out, even on that last possession. You know, Orlando knew what they wanted to do. They want to run a pick and roll or a pick on Marcus Gasol, get the switch. He knew he wouldn't come out on DJ Augustine. Augustine was going to knock down the shot. It's like Toronto wasn't necessarily prepared for this game.
Yeah, and I know Toronto has a history, too, of losing game ones, especially in the first round. So that trend continues, of course. And also, I saw a fun fact today that no team has ever won an NBA title after losing game one in the first round series. It's been done three times, and all three times were the Spurs. ESPN posted that today. So not a great start for the Raptors, who have title aspirations, if you're going by history.
Yeah, no, obviously history is important, especially when you're looking back. And I think just momentum and confidence has an impact in the series. Now, looking at this one, is there any chance Orlando could pull the upset, or Toronto's going to clean up their stuff and take care of this one in five or six?
I think that Toronto's pretty much going to win this series. I think it's going to be six because I think, like Corey said, I think that Orlando steals one at home. I just love how good and effectively Orlando played defense, especially kind of before Kawhi went on that little mini run in the fourth quarter. I thought that Aaron Gordon definitely stepped up and played as an ISO defender because, you know, you go to Kawhi as sort of that ISO offense. That seems like it's kind of been the norm for any team that Kawhi is on. But I think they win one at home, but I just don't know about their chances in the series going to seven. So I'm going to say it's probably about maybe a 25% chance, 30% chance. So
yeah, I mean, for me, like, game one to me is an outlier for the Magic out on the road.
And shooting wise, I think they shot really well from three in that game. And that's not something they necessarily do, especially DJ. I mean, DJ Augustine's have a career year, but he shot like 60 or 70% from the field.
Yeah, I know he was 4 or 5 from three, which is ridiculous for Augustine. I know as a team, they only averaged three made threes a game. And I believe they finished with 14 or 15 on the game. So again, they shot above their mark. That's going to have an impact. And again, they had some really nice contribution from role players. You know, Michael Carter Williams Jr., we know how his NBA career has been, but he had a tremendous impact in the third quarter and then earlier in the fourth. He really started to get Orlando back into it. He had a bunch of buckets, a couple threes. The bloody nose probably almost energized his team for the fact that it wasn't called. And then
Nwandu.
He played 9 minutes, and I have to say it was the most impactful 9 minutes of a role player I saw in that game. He had a deflection. He had a steal. I believe he had 5 points. He was just really effective and aggressive on defense, and that was also the same point, like the same time frame as Michael Carter Williams Jr. You generally don't get that kind of impact in the series like this from role players. Like, I'm not expecting Michael Carter Williams Jr. to be that much of an impact for the rest of the series.
Ever.
Right.
Dylan Jackson's listening. Don't be throwing shit at his boy.
He's also probably rolling on the floor right now because, I mean, it's got to be painful. And that's rookie of the year, Michael Carter Williams, to you, Corey.
Yeah. Well, it's true. On a very very low talent Sixers team back in the day. But I'll give Orlando a 20% chance to upset in this series. Because I still think if you take game one, there is still that outside chance that maybe they steal game two. And then if they steal game two, this is a completely different series. So I think as of right now, I'll give them 20% after winning game one.
Yeah, it's probably like 5% or below for me. I just think Toronto's going to handle their stuff. They're just way too talented. And defensively, like I mentioned, they weren't really engaged. And just another shout-out to an Orlando role player. Birch played really well off the bench, and he's been a guy who's been big for them all year long. Now, moving on to Clippers and Warriors. What'd you guys think about this one? Obviously, Warriors won game one, 121-104. Steph Curry, 38, 15, and 7.
Steph Curry, I have no words. What a performance that the chef put on. I mean, the man put on a display all night long. The shooting clinic, passing Ray Allen in the fashion that he did. I know he hit the 1-3 where it seemed like he did the splits on his way down, which is absolutely nuts, but definitely doesn't surprise me with him. But, you know, I just think that this was a game that I love the antics between Pat Beverly and Kevin Durant. But unfortunately for Beverly, he only finished with 3 points. So, I mean, I love the antics there coming from a Rockets fan. I know what he brings to the table. But if you're expecting to push this into an actual series, which you have an actual chance at maybe contending, you have to get contribution on the offensive and from guys who aren't used to contributing that substantially. Because, I mean, him and Shamet only finished with 3 points. And it sucks because Montrezl Harrell and Lou Williams had 51 combined and had an absolute great game combined. So I just don't think that the Clippers have enough firepower. And I think that Golden State, there's a real chance that they win this in four.
Yeah, I still think this is going to be a sweep. Game one still solidified that for me. Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell, they're fantastic for the Clippers. I think Zubac got kind of exposed by DeMarcus Cousins a little bit. As you mentioned, Curry having 15 rebounds is absurd and bad for any opposing team. If Curry's going to grab 15 rebounds and score 35-plus points, you're probably going to lose every single game because that's just an issue. And, you know, the Pat Beverly versus Kevin Durant, I know Nick mentioned when we were watching on Saturday, there's a really big height differential there. So realistically, you're not going to upset Kevin Durant's shot too much, Patrick Beverly. But, you know, he plays hard. He plays gritty. He tries to get underneath the skin. Obviously, they both got ejected late in that game. But this is, you know, the Warriors are looking in prime fashion. They look dominant. And I just don't think the Clippers have enough offense or enough guys who can realistically limit the Warriors because, you know, Gallinari, yeah, he's been really good this year, but he can't defend anybody on the Warriors realistically. Everybody's a little bit too fast for him, especially laterally. So I just think there's too many mismatch that hurt the Clippers in this series and make it competitive.
The Clippers can't really defend great, and then obviously nobody can really defend the Warriors, so that's pretty much that. I mean, this series will be fun. It'll be a little bit competitive, but we are watching the game. The third quarter kind of happened, and the Warriors start to go on their kind of run, and you're like, all right, well, this one's over. The momentum's there. It's nothing against the Clippers. You know, they could still have a competitive sweep, but I'm not really expecting a ton out of this series. Not really much to touch on here. Moving on to another upset we saw, San Antonio beat Denver in game one, 101-96. Thoughts on this one?
I think the main takeaway for me is the fact that, you know, there was a lot of downplaying of the shooting woes that Denver had kind of late in the season, and it still shone bright, especially maybe even brighter in the playoffs. I mean, they shoot, 21.9% from deep opposed to San Antonio shooting over 45%. So, I mean, I understand of how well Jokic played, but the fact of the matter is Denver not shooting the ball well against a team that does shoot the ball well. I think the Spurs are one of the more disciplined teams, well-coached teams in the NBA. So I think that there's a real chance of a potential upset here, although I still have Denver winning, maybe even in six, maybe in seven, depending on what happens in game two. But, I mean, for the Spurs fan base, I mean, you have to be ecstatic. I love how Derek White has busted onto the scene this year. Really
a huge plays in that game.
Oh, and, you know, I think he finished with, 16 points. But I think that a lot of his impact goes beyond the stat sheet because I think he does a lot of things well, things that some guys don't necessarily do and some things that don't show up on the stat sheet. But I think for Denver, you're going to have to get more out of the bench as well.
I mean, you know, I picked the Spurs in seven in our predictions before the playoffs, and game one kind of confirmed a lot of my issues. I think Denver's fluky. I just don't think they match up well in the playoffs. The offense, as you mentioned, Dalton, has hit a shooting slump at the worst possible time. I think LaMarcus Aldridge has a serious advantage over Jokic, especially on the offensive side of the ball. Jokic had a lot of assists, a lot of rebounds. So he played his game realistically, but defensively, just a liability. DeRozan played well. And then Rudy Gay was fantastic off the bench. You mentioned Derek White had that huge hammer dunk. He played above his ceiling. Patty Mills has some clutch shots. And I really just feel like Coach Popovich, like, this is the biggest X factor. He's got the experience. He's just a better coach. And I feel like in game one, he just severely outcoached Mike Malone. Granted, the shooting woes for Denver are there, but I just like Spurs' experience, and I like what they have right now. They're just a team that's also rolling. They were one of the hottest teams after the All-Star break.
And I think it's not just the coaching. I think the playoff experience for the entire Spurs roster, where so you look at Denver and a lot of their young guys haven't been in the playoffs. They're not used to the situation where, you know, DeRozan, Aldridge have been there. A lot of the guys on the bench have been there. So I think there's just more of a confidence. And I think game one was a nice, like, wake-up call for Denver. I still like the series to go deep to seven. I picked Denver, but I wouldn't be surprised if San Antonio was able to kind of capitalize on the young team. Now, moving till Sunday, first game of the day on Sunday, Corey doesn't really want to talk about it, but the Celtics won at home 84-74 and probably the lowest scoring game we've seen in a few years in the playoffs.
Yeah, I thought that there was a prime opportunity for Indiana coming in this game, especially, I mean, you figure they Boston only scores 84 points and they still lose. I mean, Bojan was led all starters for Indiana with 12 points, which is absolutely discouraging for all of Pacer Nation. But I think that the fact of the matter is no other starter had over 8 points. So you kind of have the opportunity there, but at the end of the day, I mean, this was definitely an opportunity miss for Indiana.
I mean, 84-74. That's a score in 2019.
I kept updating the NBA page to see if it was a mistake that it was just the end of the third.
This was a 2003 playoff game score. I don't know. The Pacers' defense wasn't bad. They held the Celtics to what did they hit? The 36% shooting the Celtics shot. So it wasn't, you know, now granted, the Celtics did have some good looks, but it wasn't like the Celtics blew them out again. They were limited to 84 points, but we really saw the issues with the Pacers scoring. Doug McDermott was ice cold. He was 1-for-7. Tyreek Evans had 3 made shots in the second quarter, then didn't make a single shot the rest of the game. And he asked, like, in the second quarter, everybody on Pacers Twitter was like, yo, it's Tyreek Evans. Like, if Tyreek Evans and Corey Joseph are going to show up, we're going to win this series in 5. Corey Joseph shot 57%. He was finally getting out of his shooting woes, which was good to see. But Darren Collison, who's been dealing with some injuries, he didn't look great. Somehow, Miles Turner only gets 6 shots in an NBA game. I don't understand why
he should be taking 6 threes.
Exactly. I don't understand why we're not trying to get him involved more. I thought Domantas Sabonis was okay off the bench, but when everybody else is struggling, you can kind of clog the paint on Sabonis, and it makes life tougher for him. Thaddeus Young, he was okay scrappy wise. I mean, he had 5 steals. But, you know, and Bogdanovich had 2 steals, but those guys just weren't shooting well. And you look at the flip side, there's not going to be many games where you hold Kyrie to 6-of-17 for the field for 20 points. He only had, I think, 15 point or 14 points through 3. So they did a tremendous job on him. But then Marcus Morris comes off the bench and he has 20 and he's killing you hitting every single 3. You know, Rozier hits that buzzer beater to end the third. It wasn't a bad game in terms of defense. It's just we really saw how the Pacers have no offense. And now the Celtics are in the driver's seat. And I think the Celtics might even win this in 4 games, maybe 5. I don't think it's as long as a series anymore after seeing game 1.
I think the problem with the Pacers, and this was concerned going to the series, and we talked about it on the preview, was what are they going to do when you have to get into isolation situations and somebody's going to have to score? Do they have any mismatches they can really create? I think that's something Nate McMillan's going to have to do. He's going to sit down, look at the tape, like, hey, is there any way that our guys can score? Like, Bojan's a good player. I don't want to say he's a great player. He's having a great season. But he's not a guy that's going to be your number one option. He's going to be good defenders one-on-one. He's not going to take Jaylen Brown off the dribble and score on him on ease. Like, it's just a good defense. Especially, I thought Brad Stevens did a nice job going big and starting Aaron Baines and Al Horford. You know, he's done that a lot this year, but there was some talk about maybe not doing that. I thought they played a lot of bigs to kind of match up with the Celtics, and they just made it really tough, and they disrupted their offense. They're like, all right, beat us with ISO ball, and the Pacers couldn't. You know, maybe they need more Tyreek Evans. I know I saw a lot of Pacer fans. Maybe that's a guy we can look to because he can actually create off the dribble, but if you're really depending on Tyreek Evans to win you a series, like, what are your hopes at?
Yeah, and you mentioned rebounding. The Celtics out-rebounded the Pacers 55-42 rebounding, and that's a huge differential.
Especially in a low-scoring game like that where both teams don't shoot well, there's boards to be taken. So I just feel like it's going to be tough. The Pacers are going to have to find a way to kind of grit this game out and get a win, and this is probably as gritty as you can get in a playoff game, 84-74.
Yeah, and the Pacers also shot 57% from the free throw line. You have to make your free throws. They were 12-for-21. So granted, they lost by 10, but still, you hit 80% of those. Maybe you put more pressure on the Celtics and things change. You got to hit your free throws. You can't shoot under 70% from the free throw line in the NBA playoff game and win.
It's gonna be a tough series, and I kind of agree with the sense that, you know, this series could end a little bit closer than we anticipated. I think there was some fear going to the series. Obviously, anytime you lose your star player, you know, a top shooting guard in the NBA and Victor Oladipo, it hurts your offense to a dramatic, you know, expense. So be interested to see how they react in game two. You know, I think more importantly, how they react in game three in Indiana, because game two is in Boston, obviously, and they're going to probably play well. So it's going to be interesting. Moving on from there, this was a really fun game. Game one of OKC in Portland. Portland won at home 104-99.
I think the concern coming into the playoffs, because there's been those reports for OKC of how bad is Paul George's shoulder injury. Well, he had 26. Bad. He had 26 and 10. So, I mean, it can't be severe enough to where it just hinders his performances, but you never know going forward. So, it's really hard to dictate the direction of this series. But I love how Portland played. Lillard, Kanter, and CJ all combined for 74 points, which is what you like to see. You like to see Enes Kanter playing well in the absence of Joseph Nurkic. I mean, Russell Westbrook with a 24, 10, and 10, triple-double. This is a series that a lot of people had OKC coming out of and even potentially going to the Western Conference Finals. But I love how Damian Lillard played in Game 1, especially of how he got owned by Jrue Holiday last year in the first round against
New Orleans.
New Orleans. But I thought it was a great opener for Portland. I thought that they played well. So I think it's just a matter of staying consistent. But for OKC, I think that the concerns with Paul George's shoulder is it's only going to get worse and worse. So there's really – and with the playoff games getting more intense and getting more frequent, especially if OKC is to advance after this round, there's a real fear that, I mean, their playoff run could be capped due to his health alone.
I mean, if you're OKC you know, you look at the box score and only four members of Portland scored over double digits. You know, Lillard had 30, McCollum had 24, Kanter had 20 and 18. Kanter had his best game of his entire NBA career, was engaged defensively.
I don't know about that. But
I mean, in the playoffs, this might be his best performance in the playoffs. Best
playoff
at least.
Game probably for sure.
Yeah.
Defense was actually competent, and it wasn't at the fact where going to the series, I thought Steven Adams was really going to own him, but he held his own.
Yeah, he was a nice surprise. And then McCollum, for a guy who missed some time to end the year with an injury, he looked pretty spry, I thought. I was impressed with him in the first half. He got a little bit out of rhythm in the second half, but in the first half, he was really aggressive. Lillard hit that logo shot to start the game, and that was just
like, yo, what's up? I'm about to body
Yeah,
you.
This is the – I'm going to set the tone. It's a little bit of Dame time. So I really liked him. And then you look at OKC. This is a team that shot 5 for 33 from three.
That's terrible.
You're not going to win playoff games when you can't hit the long ball. Paul George, I'm sorry, Dalton. Yeah, he had 26 and 10, but he did not look good. He did not look right to me at all offensively. He was 4 for 15 from three or 3 for 15. He looked out of rhythm. Didn't look like he had he said – that 2 days before the game, he couldn't lift his arms above his shoulders. Like he couldn't do this. And after the game, he said, I'm in no pain. He had a 7-pound bag of ice on his shoulder. And he's like, I'm in no pain. Like, what do you got that giant ass ice pack for up there, bub? I don't think he's healthy. I think he's banged up, obviously. I liked Russell Westbrook offensively. I thought he was engaged. I wasn't necessarily disappointed with that. Defensively, I mean, I don't know who he thought he was guarding at times. He kind of sagged off Lillard at some inopportune moments.
That was just like too funny. Like, I get like Westbrook's probably like, yo, I want to guard Dame. But bro, if you're gonna guard Dame, you have to guard him. Like, literally.
Does that surprise you though? Because there's a lot of times where Russell Westbrook gets caught either ball watching or lackadaisically sitting there and getting beat on either a backdoor cut or a screen. I think for Portland, I think the matter of the fact is now you kind of – it's almost kind of like the Pete Maravich syndrome in college. You let him get his, and you just shut everybody else down. And it worked for the most part on the first game.
The most important thing Corey mentioned was the 5 of 33 from three. Like, you're not – honestly, if you don't knock down 10 threes in a playoff game, you're probably not going to win or at least shoot a respectable percentage unless the other team's shooting really bad. And it felt like Portland was like, all right, guys, shoot some threes. We know you're not going to make them. And then the Paul George thing. Dude, I would have just rested Paul George game one, especially if he was that banged up. It's a long series. You lose the first one on the road. No big deal. You come back, bounce back game two, even game three. But now you play George. Maybe he's a little bit more injured. but OKC is not going to win the series unless someone starts knocking down threes. Is it Grant? Is it Schroeder? Is it Westbrook? Because we don't know what to expect from PG.
It's not Westbrook.
And that's another concern. Dennis Schroeder has become really bad as of late. You know, he was in the sixth man of the year race for a while, and he's just fallen out of rhythm. He was 5-for-17 in game one, took some bad shots, I thought. Not a very good defender. You know, there's just not a lot of offensive weapons outside of Russell Westbrook and Paul George. Obviously, Adams is a good third option, but again, Adams isn't creating his own shots. He's literally getting buckets off what Westbrook and Paul George create for him. So that's an issue. And then Jeremy Grant, Terrence Ferguson, those guys were crucial to any success this team had. They only had 11 points combined. The role players for OKC have to step up. Granted, you know, OKC shot 39% from the field. Portland only shot 41%. So again, this wasn't like both of these teams were shooting, you know, fantastic from the field. It was just Portland had their key three guys at this point in time all perform, where the Thunder only had Adams and probably Westbrook, and then, you know, whatever you want to gauge Paul George's games. I think it was a really empty 26 points.
Yeah, it wasn't good. He shot like 33%, 8 of 24.
Yeah.
I think also you look at it as like coaching. You know, this is another Stotts, probably out-coached Billy Donovan. They asked him, they're like, yo, why do you think they went away from going at Cantor or getting him in that pick-and-roll situation? They just stopped doing it. Like, it was going to work. It worked early on. Adams was getting layups in the paint, and he was eating. Like, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I want to say like 8 to 10 of his points came in the first quarter. And it's like, yo, if they're going to keep doing that, you keep attacking the same way. It's the playoffs. We've seen it in a different series. Like, yo, just keep getting the mismatch, keep getting the mismatch. It's like, at some point, you know, like Billy Donovan has gotten some unfair criticism. But in this situation, if they don't win this series, you know, Paul George is banged up. I think he's probably gone.
Yeah. You know, I think pretty known at this point. I'm a big Billy Donovan fan because I'm a big Florida Gator fan when it comes to college basketball. And I remember his back-to-back title. Don't give me that face. We had Joakim Noah, Al Horford, Corey Brewer, and it was fantastic. But yeah, realistically, if OKC gets bounced in the first round again, I don't like saying this because fan bases don't get, you know, insulted. OKC was better than Utah, I think, last year, talent-wise. I think they're better than Portland talent-wise this year, personally. So, again,
depending on Paul George, I think that's where it's like
hard. That's true. Okay, that's fair. Because this has been 2 years in a row, too, that Paul George is hurt. Obviously, he had the knee surgery following last season, and the shoulder injuries, well, double shoulder injury. That's another thing. It's not just one shoulder. It's both shoulders that he's, you know, one's worse than the other, of course. But he's just not 100%. And like we mentioned, it's not going to be 100% in this series and probably not in the playoffs, because injuries just don't get better when you have to play. And this is going to be a long series, even if they are able to win it.
And he's going to have to keep shooting. Like, it's not like his shoulder is going to get rest. Yeah. Even the days off, he's going to shoot warm-ups or whatever it may be. There's just a lot of concern, I think, for OKC. It's going to really be on Russell Westbrook and Steven Adams to win the series and the other guys to just kind of pick up their game.
Yeah, despite Paul George's shoulder injury last year and the disappointing loss to Utah, after beating them 3 out of 4 times in the regular season, I think it's kind of the timing is more of the essence this season because of how good Paul George has been this season. I mean, he was a prime MVP candidate in January until the shoulder injury, and then he kind of falls off. And then you see OKC going from the third seed down to the 8th seed, back up to the 6th seed on the final 2 days. So I think that there's definitely kind of, it's a timing, okay, at some point, we're going to have to get past the first round because we have to maximize the prime of both Westbrook and Paul George. But with health, if you can't stay healthy, then there's only so much you can do.
And this goes to another point. Sorry to cut you off, Corey. This is why it's important to rest players during the season, let them play proper minutes and not overplay them. I think it comes back to bite you. And you probably know this a little bit, Dalton, from James Harden. Like, that's my biggest concern for the Rockets is he going to get fatigued? That's why his game ones, his game twos, his game threes or whatever are fine. Then when you get to the second half of the series, he's gassed out. Like, it's a lot to ask a guy to do that, especially with playoff intensity.
Yeah, the one thing I was going to say about Paul George is, you know, it's even though he's had a great year, averaged 28 points per game, I know for a fact, I don't know the exact number, but he had somewhere between 35 and 45 games this year where he shot under 40%. So even when he was healthy, there were still nights where he just doesn't have rhythm. And that's been an issue for him as of the last couple of years. The jump shot at times just goes non-existent. And you put that into the fact that now he's got some shoulder issues, that's problematic. And again, I think everybody agrees that Russell Westbrook and Steven Adams are probably going to have to be the driving forces along with some role players to step up if they want to get past Portland, especially because I think Portland's got that chip on their shoulder right now.
And if Ganter is going to play well, I think it's a game changer. And you mentioned CJ early on, but we do have to move on from the series and talk a little bit about the last two games. Obviously, not really a ton to say about Detroit and Milwaukee. Milwaukee just put the damn beat down on Detroit. Obviously, no Blake Griffin, but let's be honest, Blake isn't making this a W. That was just, I don't want to say an embarrassing performance by Detroit because like they just were completely outmatched. But I don't know what, I mean, this is kind of what I expected in the series, to be honest.
Do we have to talk about this?
No, I'm just – one thought because that's really all deserved. Nah, there's not really much to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only bright spot for Detroit last night was Luke Kennard going for 21, 4-for-5 from deep. He's been a guy that you really don't know what his direction is in the franchise going forward. But you're right. I mean, there were six guys from Milwaukee that scored double figures. Definitely outmatched, especially with that Blake Griffin. I thought this series was going to be a sweep. No, I definitely think this series is going to be a sweep. I just don't think it's going to be close. I really would have loved to have seen Miami or Charlotte in this role, despite if Dylan Jackson thinks Charlotte would lose by more. I do think that they'd make it a better series than Detroit would.
They led by as many as 43 points at one point. Antetokounmpo played just 23 and a half minutes and had 24 points.
He played too many minutes. He shouldn't even been in the game in the third quarter when he got that hard foul by Drummond. Like, what are we doing here?
Exactly. He played 23 and a half minutes and had 24, 17, 4, and 1 on 9 of 17 shooting. And again, that Drummond foul, I'm telling you, I understand playoff intensity, but that could have been extremely bad had he landed the wrong way. Or, you know, all the freak things we see happen. That was really dangerous. And like you said, this game was already well over before he was in that third quarter that he almost got hurt.
It's almost like they had to play him for conditioning. They're like, Giannis, we got to actually play you 20 minutes because we want you to stay fresh. We have a 2-day break. Like, all right, we want to keep the legs good.
Yeah.
Not much to say here. They can't defend Giannis. Yeah. They can't defend anything. I mean, offensively, they're gonna have struggles. And that's I'm not even trying to disrespect Detroit.
It's true. It's bad because everything you said is true.
Like, dude, no one wanted to play Milwaukee. Like, Orlando and Brooklyn, they were so happy to get 6 and 7. At least there's somewhat of a chance to beat the Sixers and the Raptors. Nobody was upsetting Milwaukee in the first round. Like, they're just too good. Their team is stacked, and they're not even fully healthy yet. So, I mean, it's good for them. That's all I got to really say. And then on to the final game of last night. You know, Dalton's happy to talk about this one. Houston ended up blowing this one open, 122-90. And another good game one performance from James Harden, almost a triple-double, 2 rebounds shy.
You know, coming into this series, and actually since Coach D'Antoni's been in Houston, I've always thought that it's in his contract that if Houston has a 15-point lead, he's forced to blow it to let the team come back. But, I mean, definitely it kind of looked like that was going to happen early in the third quarter when they cut it to 7. But in the fourth quarter, Chris Paul took over, and they ended up winning by, I think, 122-90. And definitely impressed by James Harden's performance. But, I mean, he had 29, 10, and 8, like you said, flirting with a triple-double. And one thing that really stood out to me was just the confidence and being able to hit shots because, like the notion is saying, I mean, he does kind of struggle in the playoffs sometimes with his true shooting ability, but he definitely played smart on Sunday night.
You know, I was live tweeting on OTG and I had the unfortunate, draw of having 3 blowout games. Well, 3 bad games and 1 good game. But I mean, Houston did what they were supposed to do. I think, I mean, for Houston who has title aspirations, they're already looking ahead to the Warriors, no disrespect to the Utah Jazz, but the Rockets expect to win this series. And game one to me looked like just that. They just looked like they wanted it more. You know, Ricky Rubio had 15 points, I think, with like 8 or 7 minutes to go in the third quarter, then didn't score the rest of the game. Donovan Mitchell was okay. I thought he was more aggressive in the first half than he was in the second half. Rudy Gobert was okay. But again, like that 2-big-man system just doesn't work against Houston. They play small. They run you off the floor. When James Harden is playing as good as he's playing here, watch out. I thought Chris Paul looked really good at the facilitator. He was efficient, didn't have to do too much. Clint Capella was dominant in the paint. I liked Kenneth Faried in the stretch that he got. I just thought Houston looked dominant. You know, everybody was hitting threes, a collective effort on that end. The questionable defense by Ricky Rubio by giving James Harden the lane, or I know you're trying to push him right this is the NBA. We're not like 12 years old. Pushing somebody to their non-dominant hand doesn't really work necessarily, especially when you're
an MVP type player. We're not talking about like a young guy that's like 22 or 23. Like, let's say Donovan Mitchell has a really strong hand and he's favoring that side. Like, whatever, maybe you try that. But in what way was letting James Harden get to the middle of the floor and break down your defense ever going to work?
It wasn't.
You're just exposing yourself to the highest extent. You know, I get it, trying to force him right, but you don't say, hey, just walk by. Like, yeah, you force him right and you make it a little bit more difficult. I think Utah has to make some major adjustments. There's an opportunity for Utah to make this series more interesting. Like, they have some pieces, but they're going to have to play guys like Jay Crowder more minutes. Like, they're going to have to play their wings. Their wings are going to have to step up. Like, a guy like Royce O'Neal, like, he needs to have a big series.
Well, and a guy like Joe Ingles, like, you can't only take four shots. Like, yeah, I understand his focus, his defense, and helping move the ball around, but playing 32 minutes and being maybe the second best 3-point shooter on the team, depending on where you see Donovan Mitchell, you can't only take four shots in the game.
Yeah, he was so critical in last year's series against OKC to even get to play the Rockets. I think for Utah to have a serious chance, Donovan Mitchell's got to be more efficient. Only 7 for 18 last night. I know he had a 19 points, but I think like a double-digit negative box score last night. But with that being a blowout, not necessarily too big of a surprise there. But what got me the alarming stat was the bench for Utah. I mean, 9 points from Jay Crowder led all bench scorers for Utah, which is absolutely kind of baffling in a series which you need guys to step up and score. This is just a prime opportunity for Houston. It's a good matchup, regardless if Utah is one of the top teams coming off the All-Star break, just because, like Nick, you said, they try to run the two big lineup, and that's not really a great tactic to go against Houston, and also letting James Harden get within the restricted area, especially with the insurgence of his floater, which is night and day from last season to this season, not only mentioning the guys he has on the outside and the potential for the alley-oop to Capella, so...
And two more things I just want to touch on real quick. You know, Eric Gordon.
Long game.
Yeah, Eric Gordon was efficient, shot 50% from the field. That was a big plus. And then if you're Utah, what's concerning is he's only got to the line 12 times. That's not like them to only shoot 12 free throws, so that's concerning. And then when it comes to the turnover differential, Utah had 18 turnovers. Houston had only 10. You can't give an offense like Houston that many free possessions. They're going to burn you way too many times. And also, fun fact, Derek Favors was the only Utah Jazz with a positive plus-minus at +1.
Schematically, it's a lot on Quinn Snyder to kind of come up with some schemes to try to make this a series. I think, obviously, the matchup isn't great for them, and then the Rockets are just a better team. And I think the Rockets understand how to play with James Harden and Chris Paul. Like, that team knows what their role is and what they need to do and when they need to be active and when they need to kind of just sit back and let Harden do the thing and set them up. And the way that Utah played them, they're going to have an opportunity to do that. I mean, I still obviously think Houston's going to win the series. Utah's going to have to have some major adjustments if they even want to push it 6 or 7.
Houston game, 5.
Game 2 is going to be very critical to this series, because if you let Houston go up 2-0, I mean, it really honestly could be 4. I think it's going to be 5, because I think Utah ultimately wins 1 in Salt Lake. But, yeah, you know, Ricky Rubio came out today, yesterday in an interview and said that they were going to continue this style of defense against Harden because they're testing how much contribution that he can make with driving to the rim like that. And I think that's absolutely – I hope it's a false quote, because that's absolutely blasphemous to even think that, because of – I think we misunderstand how a lot of times of how good of a creator and how high of court vision James Harden has. It kind of gets lost in the way of his overall scoring, but he's definitely got one of the best court visions in the NBA.
Yeah, no, he's a great passer when he needs to be. He understands what he has to do. He can whip the ball around. But, guys, before we get out of here, let's get our picks in for tonight. And also, Michael mentioned in the group chat for YouTube that Embiid will play tonight as well. He asked me if I'm going to be a game 3 if you want to meet at Barclays Center. But – back to picks for tonight. Quickly, what are you guys rolling with?
Go ahead, Corey. I'll listen to you.
I'm going with Philly tonight. Realistically, I think Philly bounces back at home and they take game 2. But, I mean, watch out. Because, again, I think if for Brooklyn, I mean, Embiid's not 100%. So even if he's playing tonight, he's still not 100%. Hopefully Jared Allen cannot get into foul trouble. I think that will be better at trying to limit Joel Embiid for whatever that may be. And if the Brooklyn Nets can have all three of their guards, D'Lo, Spencer and Caris LeVert playing as efficient as they did on game one, Philly will be in trouble.
Yeah, I like Philly in this game. You know, Reddick and Harris both went 2 for 7 on Saturday. I mean, Ben Simmons 4 for 9. I think that those guys definitely step up. I think J.J. Redick actually has a big game tonight because it's usually rare to see him struggle 2 games in a row, especially
struggled against the Nets all season long. Because they didn't plan against him. He shot 25% from 3 in the regular season. We talked about this. Spencer Dinwiddie was on his hip the entire game. No clean looks. I'd be surprised if J.J. Redick had a good game. I think the Sixers probably do win this. I think it'll be close down the stretch, and we'll see what happens. But most likely, Philly's going to win this game. I think, honestly, Jared Dudley not playing is a huge loss for the Nets, not because he's an amazing player, but the presence he brings on the court, just the small things, the intangibles. He did a great job of pissing off the Sixers. If it was Joel Embiid, if it was Ben Simmons, whoever it may be, I think not having him out there is really going to hurt them. Corey brought up a great point. Jared Allen, I'm really interested to see how he bounces back. Usually does well after a really bad game. Now on to the second game of tonight, Clippers and Warriors.
I'm going with the Warriors. I think this is really a no-brainer.
I'm just kidding.
I just think, especially in Oracle, think of context, this is the last season that Oracle would be used for Golden State's home. So I just think that on top of that, not only that, the playoff atmosphere is going to be electric. You have the team that they have. And if Curry plays even a fraction of how he played on Saturday night, I still don't think this is close unless guys for the Clippers contribute more than they should. But I think that Golden State wins this in a landslide as well.
I want to say, I didn't think about this. This could be like a huge plus for the Golden State Warriors in general, that if this being the last time they're playing in Oracle, their playoff atmosphere at home for this series and run could be crucial to them in the playoffs.
Crazy. Like, they have one of the best home courts in the NBA.
It's unreal.
And Steph really feeds the crowd. Like, that's one thing he does. Like, some people hate his celebrations, but that just, like, gets the crowd going. Like,
yeah.
He looks so engaged. Like, I was saying to Corey and Jack on Saturday, like, I want him to win Finals MVP, and it looks like he really wants to win Finals MVP and have a historical postseason run. And, I mean, I'm going with Golden State here. It's not even a real question.
I won't even be watching. I'll be going to bed because I'm not really concerned about who's going to win this. This is the only – this series, and now, unfortunately, because Blake Griffin's not healthy, that these two number one seeds versus eight seeds, I just had no interest in.
Yeah, I mean, this series at least has a little bit of fun to it with the annex and whatnot, where Milwaukee and Detroit, like, I wasn't excited, and now I'm 0% excited for that series, and I might watch a game. I'll probably watch them, but I'm not promising I'll stay for the entire thing. All right, guys, any final thoughts before we get out of here?
I just want to see one upset, one series upset that shouldn't happen. Maybe it's Brooklyn. Maybe it's a team like Orlando, although I don't see it. Maybe it's a team like OKC. I just want to see an upset. I want to see a team that's not necessarily supposed to be there, like, or maybe even the Spurs, like Corey has predicted. So,
yeah, I wouldn't even call OKC a true upset because the games are so separate. I think if I'm looking at upsets, I'm thinking either the Nets or the Spurs. Corey, any thoughts on that before we get out of here?
I like upsets. I like good basketball. Hopefully the Nets Sixers come out with some intensity. I'm looking forward to that. I think this is going to be one of the best series we have. I thought it was going to be like Pacers Celtics. It might actually be Nets Sixers.
I felt confident all the way. But as always, guys, thanks for hopping on. Thank you, everybody, for checking us out. iTunes, Block Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, Google Play, and YouTube.